Viola Williams, Reel 22.
We got a young counsellor in, and she had a room in a huge secondary school. I mean, it was about what, a couple of thousand, something like that. It was a big secondary mixed school. When the black girls were finding it a terrible, terribly difficult, because they had come. If they'd come up to a secondary school, they'd come from a primary or a middle school where it was a fairly loose education, and therefore their English didn't matter all that much. They came up into the utterly structured secondary school, and where their English did matter, where they were completely out on a limb. And we started this counselling scheme in one of the biggest of the secondary schools there, where the girls could feel it wasn't the school, because the school didn't know how to deal with them. This was something where they could go, they could talk it over. Our girl, if necessary, would go to their home and talk it over with them. You see, most of their parents were practically illiterate. Therefore, a girl in a secondary school going home could get no support from her family at all. A black girl. And so we did have this scheme. It ran for a long time. It's running in different forms, I think, still in some of the schools in Bristol. But certainly in that school, we had a very good headmistress who was sympathetic to it, and it worked. And we found it really did make a difference to the security and the sort of stability of a lot of these girls. We were terribly lucky in the ones, in the people that we got as counsellors, because we had several while I was there, and we got good women, good girls in who could deal with things, and it was a successful project. And of course we had the problem, because it was a successful project, and that the National YWCA said, we want some publicity on this. We'll send down the radio, we'll send down the press, we'll send down this, we'll send. I said, no account is anybody coming down to do publicity on this. They said, oh, but this is terribly good publicity for the YWCA. I said, I am not having my girls used as guinea pigs to feel that it will throw them right back again. Oh, dear, we did have those dreadful battles on that. I remember Joyce Coxon came down from London. She was the boss of the Y at the time. She came down and she was absolutely livid because we wouldn't do it. But we said we were not going to have the press and the media in on it. This was a terribly, terribly personal thing. In the end, we did. But it was not for a long time. We got over all of the preliminary hiccups and everything. And it was a long time before we did. And then we got a grant from UNICEF for it. Because my white colleague in Bristol, who is still one of my best friends, and who was headmistress of a mixed school, not the school we were dealing with, but headmistress of another mixed school. And she was quite brilliant with all her kids. And ultimately, she did get this up to the UN, and we did have a grant from UNICEF for it. And we brought out quite a lot of literature on it too, which was used by the YWCA. But it was all left over from the trouble in Kenya and Uganda, and the fact that we'd had trouble in this country and were short of staff, short of people, and we brought them over to fill up the gap. And it didn't always work. The worst sample I had of that was, I did quite a lot with the Indian women, most of whom didn't speak any English at all. I was trying to speak wasn't quite good either. But anyway, we managed. And one family I got. Well, you can't help getting involved in these things, and I got involved in one family with four or five children. and the woman was very dependent. I mean, they didn't know what day to put the dustbin out, and they didn't know what they could get out of National. It was terrible, and we had to sort of deal with all that sort of thing. And this was the Asians, who were pretty intelligent. But one family, I was just going to bed one night when the woman of the family arrived with a little boy of about 10, I think, and she said that he'd fallen over two or three days before, and he had broken a milk bottle, and he cut his wrist very badly on a milk bottle. And she said she didn't know what to do with it, so she wrapped it up in lavatory paper, and the lavatory paper was still on it, and I said, and it was obviously, I mean, it was pretty grim. So I said, all right, I'll take him up to the casualty hospital at Pension. And I didn't take her because she'd got to worry the rest of her family that she was dealing with. And I took him up and we went to casualty and we registered what we were doing there, we took our turn. And when I went in with him, it was a black Sudanese doctor. And the little boy took one look at him and said, I'm not going to be touched by that nigger. I mean, just like that. I mean, that gives you an idea of the kind of tensions that we were dealing with there. He did, I mean, we made no bones about it, and the surgeon dealt with him. And his own doctor, two or three weeks later, said he couldn't have found another job himself. He made a really good job of it. But I said, no, I'm not going to be touched by that nigger. Just like that. 10. I mean, how am I going to expect peace in this world? I just don't know. But we also took a party of mixed kids, a gang of us got together, and including the black community social worker, and for two or three years we took kids down to Exmouth to live in Canvas for a week down from the really, really badly privileged families. We were very careful when we went down and got them from the families, but they really did need a break of some sort. The first night, always, the first thing we had to do, the first night always, was to go around and take all the knives away, because nearly all the kids had got knives. They were 11, 12, 13-year-olds, and nearly all the black boys, and some of the brown boys, had all got knives, and we had to collect them all before we could get any further. The thing there that I found most interesting was that we took them all out into the sea, because there's a lovely sea bathing there. And what we found was that all of these kids could swim. They'd all got swimming baths in Bristol. They'd all been going to baths. They could all swim. They had never met tides and currents before. And that coast is notoriously tides and currents. And we had to form a barricade of a staff, just about neck depth, beyond which we couldn't let the kids go, because they just did not understand. It was really interesting that we had again, you see, you never know when things are going to work out, because in the same camp. And we had to mix, because we all went together for our meals. In the same camp, there was a gang of French kids, about the same age, who'd come over. And one or two of those are still corresponding with each other. The French and our, they mixed magnificently. And I think the effect that we've got the French there acted as a kind of catalyst. And it was very interesting that we could have had real good reactions on that one, but in the end it worked out all right.
Do you think, looking back, it was a mistaken policy to have placed Asians next to sort of Caribbean people? Was it insensitive?
I don't think it would have done anything else. The kind of thing that happened was that you got, and this happened almost everywhere, you got one family who came in, a black family or a brown family who came in, and they then got their relations in, and their relations in, and their relations in, and so you finally got a sort of enclave of whatever it was that came in, because they came in through their relations. And it was extraordinary how, particularly with the Asians, it wasn't long before any employable Asian was employed, probably by other Asians, but employed. Whereas the wretched Caribbeans were not in that sort of situation. It always made for tension. And I'm very glad I did it. I don't know that I did an awful lot of good, but it was a very interesting experience, and it's one that I was able to use occasionally when I went to other places, which was always useful.
Yes, your work at home and abroad seems very intertwined from what you've been saying.
I've always considered that as that kind of worker, that my job has really been to interpret us to the developing countries and the developing countries to us. Because you go to almost, even today, you go to almost any charity that is collecting for an overseas project, and the conception here, even today, is that somewhere out in the world, black, brown or yellow, are holding their hands out waiting for charity. And at the other end, they get money in a check, probably larger than any of their family ever had, for the organisation. It's come in as quite a big check. And my effort there has had to be to explain that check did not just come out of the sky. It came from sixpence from this woman, and sixpence from that woman, and a shilling from that woman, and that it was a one lot weren't up, they would much rather do it on their own if they could. And the money that came was not just a gift from God, it had been collected by people. And I think that's one of the things that I've tried to sort of get across wherever I've been working.
This is really continuing where we left off some time ago. And I believe Nigeria was your next mission, was it, if that's the right word?
Yes, I don't know if it was a mission. When I was in Bristol, and we'd applied for the local education authority to take me over from the YWCA, and they were so tardy about it, and then quite suddenly, out of the blue, I had a telegram from Geneva saying, would I go to Nigeria and help pick up some of the pieces after the Nigerian war? And so within 3 weeks or so, I was in Geneva, and then we had a dreadful time trying to get a Nigerian visa, because the YWCA in Nigeria was not the lot that were fighting the war. The two bits were slightly against each other, and it was the national that had to ask for me, and it was the national that didn't want me. And so it took a long time before we could pull enough strings. I must have been in Geneva for about 6 weeks waiting to go, while we were trying to, and the wives got quite a lot of power, but we did, it was very difficult. Because I finally got my visa, and I went out, to Enugu in east central, which was the Ibu province, which was the one that had that were considered the rebels against the government. Because, as I think I said before, the Ibus were the intelligent lot in Nigeria, and therefore they were the ones that the missionaries had concentrated on, and therefore they were probably slightly more mentally civilized than some of the other tribes. Mm. And the other tribes, of course, were jealous. Mm.
This war would have been the Biafran War.
Yes, the Biafran.
Yes, and they had wanted this separate state of Biafra, is that right?
State.
The Ibus.
Yeah. Well, they considered that, and probably rightly so, that they were quite capable of coping with it. I'm not sure whether Rivers State came into East Central, because Rivers was the oil state. And it might, I don't know, that is something I never really got the bottom of. Whether Rivers worked with East Central, and therefore, because they were the oil, it was the oil area, whether that was one of the reasons. But a lot of it was, I think, was to some extent, was jealousy. But anyway, I went out to Enugu, and having gone through Lagos to get there, and having met the black representative of USAID, because USAID was going to fund whatever we did in East Central. It was, but again, there were problems, because the national YWCA considered that any aid that was going into Nigeria should be going to their side of the picture and not the East Central side. So the whole time I was there was a certain amount of tension between us, although it's all YWCA, between us and the national. I got out to Enugu, and the government gave me a flat. The East Central government gave me a flat there. So the accommodation was all right. There was very little food. There was practically nothing in the way of material commodities and things, but at least I was comparatively all right. We had a van that the East Central had given to the Y, and the woman in charge, the East Central woman in charge, made Imambolu, was an absolute sweetie. We just hit it off just straight away, and I'm still in correspondence with her. So that from that point of view, I was on an absolutely solid base right to start with. And the first thing, one of the things that the USAID money was meant for was to try and get some of the vocational training work going again, as well, if possible, if there was any sort of spare money, doing something with children and orphans. But we went down to Owerri to see, which had been, before the war, had been a very flourishing vocational training centre for teenage girls. And it was just a shell. There was no roof, there were no doors, no windows, no plumbing, no nothing. It was just some walls standing in the middle of a derelict area. And this we were going to put back as a vocational training centre. And we did. I was only there 3 months, but we got it up. We got it furnished, And then there came the question of teachers, and that we haven't got enough money for. And so we asked the central government if they would help with the teachers, as it was all part of the general education system. And the I forget what his title was, but anyway, he was the boss of, he was the political boss of East Central. And luckily I got on with him very well, but he had, I think it was his Minister of Education who was dead in us. And so we had, it took me a very long time before I finally got permission for them to pay the teachers, at least to start with, for the centre. And we got the centre going again. But even then, some of these things are just, looking back on them, they're just so silly. The USA agency, who were very much behind what we were doing, and I think we're quite pleased with the fact that we've got on fairly quickly with what the renovations. They had also agreed to let us have transport. And in due course, I had a note to say that the transport arrived in Lagos, and could I go over and deal with it? So I think I took a bus. Lagos was a long way from us. And I think it was a bus, anyway. And I got there and went down to the docks to find out about this transport. Do you know what America had sent for a war-torn, roadless area of Africa? 3 stretch black limousines with a ground clearance of about 1/2 inch. And sucking up about 7 gallons of petrol a mile. It was quite incredible. You see, the main, there was one good main road in East Central, and that had been used as the airstrip, because it was almost the only really good level piece, and there were wrecked aircraft in the bushes on both sides of the road, and the marks on the road to try and indicate to the aircraft where they could land and so on. And so to have these limousines, the whole of the road was potholes, and I really wept when I saw those vehicles. However, the National YWCA demanded one of them, and I said, no, they were not for the National YWCA, they were for us. And in the end, I think I gave one to the government of the national government of Nigeria, and the other 2 I swapped with ministers for a minibus, a kind of minibus thing, a sort of truck sort of thing, that we could carry trains, we could carry people, we could carry all sorts of things, and it had a good clearance, it had a good mileage, it was a good vehicle. And what happened to the stretch limousines, I have no idea, but I was glad to see the back of them. And I assume that they were 3 vehicles that the Americans didn't want, and they let us have them. But that is what I found so often behind the help that we've had in that indigenous people are getting from help agencies. We had snow plows in Ghana, And in Malaya, our government, I'm not sure this ought to go down, our government were given the plans for the new station and reinforced them against snow. And if you go to the Kuala Lumpur station, it has very strong pillars. If you haven't sort of experienced it, you just wouldn't believe some of the things that we've got. And the awful part about it was that probably at least half of the thought behind it was good thoughts, good helpful thoughts. But what finally emerged, of course, was impossible. I think I've said this before, that the whole world is littered with abandoned UN vehicles. Because once they break down, they break down. But we did some work. I think we worked with Save Children Fund to some extent in East Central, because they were trying to get their orphans and parents together, or their abandoned kids and parents together, and they were doing quite a lot of work on that. But we gradually, to a very large extent, the USA, but we did get quite a bit from Geneva as well, and I think that probably came from the Germans. We did get some of our nursery schools going again. We got one of our primary and secondary schools going again, and I got some help there, which direct sort of war help, which I've never had anything quite so generous as that before. I was sort of going around trying to sort out what the whole East Central needed in the way of help. And what I found was that there were a lot, the boys that I didn't touch, but there were a lot of teenage girls whose secondary schools had either been bombed or they'd been made orphans, or for various reasons they were abandoned. And they were trying to take their final examinations with no parents, no backing, no nothing. And one of them was living in a cardboard shack under a bridge, trying to take school certificate. I mean, it was just impossible. And I put out an SOS to Geneva, and they handed it on to the Norwegians, and we got a part of NORAID. We started off with 10 scholarships, and that was a very interesting job, because I had to go around and try and find kids that could benefit from the scholarships, and then the children themselves wrote back to NORAID, which made a good contact. And the Norwegians were terribly generous, because when they realised that it was a scheme that was really working, they gave us a whole lot more scholarships. And so I always felt that whatever else I'd done there, at least I'd got a few kids onto their feet again. And we were very grateful to the Norwegians for that. Otherwise, we did some work with the YM. But the thing I found in East Central was that everybody was flat out to try and get East Central back on its feet again. Notwithstanding problems from other tribes, other areas of Nigeria, the actual East Central was it was part of their whole culture. They were, they'd always been the bright lot, and they were determined they were going to be back on their feet again. And I found it very interesting because I was in Nigeria about 4 years ago.